Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we cover the news from the different parts of the world. We try to get people from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds, and try to see how each of us look at those bits of news that have been happening in the past month or so. My name is Patrick Beja, and today I'm very glad to welcome back three co-hosts to the show. First, Turkey, of course, who's always or almost always with me. When he's not on the show, I feel kind of hollow inside. How's it going, Turkey?
Ah, you're being too sweet, and I was trying to be very mean to you.
Well, I have to compensate for, you know, I have to balance out your anger and, you know, acidity.
Thank you very much.
So, very glad to welcome you back to the show. We also have Eric joining us from China. I guess China.
China, Shanghai.
Yes, Shanghai. I was thinking, is it Shanghai? Is it Shenzhen? But you just told me like 2 minutes ago. That shows how foreign China is to me. I don't know anything about China. But thanks for being on, Eric.
My pleasure.
And we will have a lot to talk about China. I think we'll start with that on this episode. And lastly, but not leastly, we have Dan joining us from Mexico. How's it going, Dan?
Hi there. Well, we have at least some curious notes, perhaps not as interesting or not as amazing as the ones that are happening in the rest of the world, but perhaps we can bring a smile in some way.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to that as well. So thanks for joining us. And as I mentioned, I think what's been happening in China is pretty interesting. So let's start with that. And when I say what's been happening in China, there's so much. It's kind of we have to pick a couple. But maybe I'll let you choose, but I would love for it to include the topic of the president becoming president for life, because that has something of an echo in our parts.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the most interesting part that's happened. That came out of something called the Two Sessions, which is the kind of the National People's Consultative Congress that gets together. That's their equivalent of a legislature. It's a rubber stamp legislature. It's not really what we would recognize as a legislature in the West. So everything's kind of preordained in advance. And it was very funny to watch the votes for Xi Jinping to become president for life, which is effectively they removed term limits from the presidency. And that had been something that was in place since 1982. And they put that there as a way to kind of prevent what the excesses happened during the Mao Zedong era in the 50s and 60s. And so there were two terms of 5 years. And China for past 25, 30 years had been really quite impressive with how predictable it had been in turning over power. And there was this cleansing that happened every 10 years where a whole administration would leave and a new one would come in. And it was it was all done very peacefully, and it was done in a way that was actually quite healthy. And now we don't have that anymore. President Xi Jinping removed that. We got a hint of that 5 years ago when we normally, after the second term begins, you start to see the kind of the next in line being groomed. And there wasn't anybody there. So that was the first hint. So this was not something that was sudden. This is something that had been planned for quite some time. But Xi Jinping now is in power for as long as he wants.
And is this, I mean, obviously, I think I'm speaking for most of the Western world. When we look at this, we're like, is that going to turn into something even worse, I think we would say? How dictatorial is it? Or is it Xi Jinping saying, I'm the man now, everyone buzz off, I'm being polite, I'm the one you have to deal with? Or is it like more of an establishment thinking, well, Xi Jinping is doing a great job, we don't want him to have to leave in a few years, so let's just, you know, let's leave him in place?
A little bit of all of that. This is definitely Xi Jinping in power. And this is a man who has consolidated more power than any Chinese leader in modern history, since the Mao era. So that by itself is very interesting. In many ways, we're seeing a kind of a reversion to the norm for China. China has never been a democracy. China has never been even that much of a republic. China has, for most of its 5,000 years of history, or at least 3,000 or 4,000 of those years, has been ruled by emperors. And so for a brief period in the 20th century, we had Republican rule, which where mandarins and bureaucrats ran the government. Now we have the party leadership running the government. And we are in some ways reverting back to what is the normal place in Chinese politics, where you have an emperor leader. That is what people are accustomed to here. And the people, but at least the system, its roots are in that. You know, not everybody's happy here. There's a lot of discontent, a lot of kind of frustration, a lot of concern and fear. So I won't say that it's universally kind of celebrated. But there is something very important to recognize about this moment in history that we're in right now. China is ascendant. China is now much more powerful than it's been in a long, long time. It's challenging the United States for hegemony in this part of the world. Asia is the most important part of the world. I hate to tell you Europeans and Americans out there, but the balance of power is shifting to Asia. 60% of the world's population's here. More trade passes through this part of the world than anywhere else. The fastest growing economies in the world. India and China alone are going to be the powerhouses of this century. And Xi Jinping sees it that this is his time. And this is an opportunity for China to really rise faster than it could have done without him, is what he says. That's the argument that he's making. They also see the gift of the clown show that's going on in the United States right now. I mean, people out here look at what's happening in the United States as a joke, but they also look at it as an opportunity. That Trump is so destructive, and it's not just Trump in many ways. It's American culture is in a spiral in so many different ways, and they see this as an opportunity for them to advance themselves.
I'm curious about this. I mean, I'm curious about a million things. Maybe I think we say this every time you come on the show. We should do a special on China alone. But one thing I'm curious about is you're saying there is some dissent, some concern. I'm wondering how it's expressed, if it's expressed at all. I know that is a very much policed state, and the network and the internet is surveilled, and it's very difficult to, I guess, say something without it being noticed somewhere. So how is discontent being expressed, if at all? And then you're saying they see American culture spiraling down, which I'm sure, you know, everyone has said that at many points of American history, and maybe it's true or truer this time, but I'm wondering how the Chinese population, you know, the media maybe, but even more the population itself sees that, like how it manifests for them.
Couple different. Yeah, these are great questions. So the way that dissent is expressed here is it's not the same as it is in other places. People say it in private, people say it to themselves, and they say it to their friends. It's not something you can necessarily get onto online and start publishing blogs that will be taken down quite quickly, thanks to the Great Firewall. And they're very, very effective at that. Chinese is a very flexible language, so people use oftentimes codes in their characters, synonyms and homonyms and different ways of expressing characters. The government usually picks up on that pretty quickly and then starts censoring that as well. So that type of expression is not there. But you just hear it in the business community. You hear it when you talk to people, and you hear it more informally. In terms of how people view the United States, it's a combination of things, and it's not any one thing. Trump by himself is actually probably more popular here among people than a lot of people would think. People really, they idolize here the corporate businessman, because in so many ways he is the antithesis of the Chinese bureaucrat, the Chinese leader. He says and does anything he wants. He is a successful billionaire, things that they aspire here very much the same way.
He has a lot of gold in his apartments.
And he has a lot of gold, and they like that too. And they respect that kind of no-nonsense, very much the same way that the white working class in the United States respects and kind of the tribal populations in the United States that are rallying behind Trump and his base. They respect the things that he says, what's on his mind. It's not scripted. And that's the opposite of Chinese politicians and Chinese leaders here. So they do admire that. But at the same time, people see a culture where they don't understand how it is possible that there are guns everywhere in the United States. They don't understand these school shootings. They don't understand the excesses. How people comment to me, why is it that Americans are so fat and overweight, and the obesity numbers? And it's just the image of it. People will ask me questions all the time about why is the United States still engaged in wars in Afghanistan when, in fact, there is no end to it? And these are the questions that just keep adding up time after time after time after time. And when you open up the newspaper over and over again and you start seeing these types of headlines, there's a certain level of disillusionment that starts to kick in. So you're seeing more young people now choosing to study in Canada, in Australia, in Europe, in other places. The visas are getting harder to get for students to go to the United States. There is a sense of a lack of appreciation now that the Trump administration wants to cut back on student visas, which is just a horrific idea. But the Chinese are paying full fare, and they feel that that's not respecting their contribution to these universities and what they're doing. So they're taking their money and they're going elsewhere. All of these combine to make a very frustrating experience watching the United States from abroad.
Yeah, I would say that many of those things you described are being felt outside of China, and I mean outside of the U.S. And I'm not just talking about Trump, although obviously that's a big factor, but especially, you know, things like the shootings and the guns are things that we wonder about. And we did a special about that last episode where we talked to gun owners. So I'm not trying to, do this very unilaterally. It's just the fact is, outside of the U.S., we just don't understand how this is possible, that it's still going on. And that contributes to this, as you were saying, the disillusionment of people who used to look at the U.S. as something to aspire to. And certainly now it's more like, yes, there are good things, but look at the bad things there are.
That's right.
And I don't want to point to guns too much because that's a factor, but it's not the only one. Things like you talked about how fat people are. And I'm sure, there are some listeners who are overweight in the audience. And I don't mean to be disrespectful to anyone, but this is something that is definitely a concern. And culturally, it feels like something that has, I'm sorry for the very bad pun, but that has weight in the way that people look at the country overseas. We certainly in France, and maybe, in France, we're probably amongst the least overweight people in Europe even. So that might overemphasize that element. But we also don't understand how that's possible, because it's very simple. Eat healthy, exercise a little bit, don't eat that much, it's about quantities, and you won't get that fat overall. Obviously, there are always
special
cases.
But the irony is that China is rapidly becoming a very obese country too, right, which is ironic. So obesity is not something that's unique to the United States by
obviously,
any measure.
Yeah.
But it is one of these, and again, that's just one of the comments that comes up, which is that people just don't understand the way we consume food. They don't understand, obviously, the way that we look at religion and politics. They don't understand the guns. And there are so many different things. The one thing that the Chinese and Chinese people are very happy with the Trump administration is that since Trump came into power, the Americans don't lecture Chinese about human rights anymore. And that has actually been a big benefit to the relationship, because that used to be a major, major sticking point. And the Chinese had started to prepare a whole series of rebuttals to American criticisms on human rights. They talk about healthcare. They talk about Black Lives Matter. All the things that we recognize that are very obvious to people like me as human rights problems in the United States, the Chinese had started building media campaigns to start highlighting that. But then Trump came in and said, you know what? We're going to take human rights off the table. And so in one sense, that has actually helped the relationship, because that used to be a very big sticking point between the two. I don't pass a judgment whether that's good or bad, but that's just the reality of what it is today.
All right. We're going to talk about North Korea as well in a second, but I do want to turn to Turkey to ask about what we were talking about earlier, the removal of the term limit for the Chinese president. And I mean, obviously, your country is not a democracy. I'm wondering how people look at, that event, if they mention it at all.
They looked at it, but not really by much, because this region is an entirely, I don't think there's a single democracy, with the exception at the moment, the real democracy would be Tunisia. But other than that, there's not much democracy going around in this country. And what democracy we have in the region is based on sectarian rule. So you have division of governments in Lebanon and Iraq, where there's specific positions for a specific person from a specific religious group. A person being ruled forever or unlimited, it's the norm in this region. You have the Gulf nations that are basically monarchies. You have Egypt, that apparently the president usually wins his elections with a 90%+. Same thing in Syria, where there's the war now. That one of the reasons is you have a leader that wins with 90%+, apparently. And Jordan is a monarchy. Iraq and Lebanon, as I said, they are democracies, but their democracies are based on dedicating positions to a specific sect, a religious sect. So, for example,
the Christian gets that position, a Christian gets that position, a Muslim, etc., etc.
So the president is a specific, has to be a Christian, I believe. The Sunni Muslim in Lebanon is prime minister. The House head of the parliament is Shiite. So that's the way they're divided in these two countries.
And it hasn't been working very well in the past few decades. So
it was a solution at the start after the civil war. And it was a good solution, but it should have been a temporary solution. And apparently it's just ended up making those facts of life and people insisting that's how it should work. And Iraq decided to adapt a similar path. The point is they're trying to give everybody power so there won't be any problems between the different religious groups, but that's not working. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is it got attention, what happened in China. People have been looking into it following it, and there was news about it. But at the end of the day, the reaction is, you know what? And this is what most people have been saying. This guy actually led China to be a prosperous and strong country. He should stay there.
Right. Yeah. I guess it makes sense when you look at it like that. But
But Patrick, one question for you. How long has Angela Merkel been in power for?
Well, if you vote her in, then she can be...
24 years she's been in power.
Okay, but that's an unfair comparison.
Really?
No,
a whole generation?
She's sure.
Been in power. Some people haven't even been alive under, 24 years is an enormous amount of time for
a
democratic country.
Is Xi Jinping going to need to go back in front of his people or his committee or whatever to be voted back in? No. Angela Merkel had to do that. And that is a very important difference, which I know you know, and you're just,
No, I'm just making the point, though, that 24 years is an enormous amount of time.
I agree. But I don't think,
and this is not to defend the Chinese in any way, because I think what Xi Jinping has done is questionable. But the point is that it's just, these are complicated situations, and it's very easy on the outside to say, why aren't you doing it like us? And at the end of the day, countries like this have to make their decisions for themselves. And, here are making the decision, but the president he's amassed more power. So he said, you know what? Guess what? I'm here for life. There you go.
Yeah. Well, I think if we get back to the image of the United States, I think we're getting, it's not like the US is sinking to the bottom of the barrel or anything like that. It's just a lot of people are thinking, well, maybe there's no idealization of the US anymore. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of great things coming out of the US still. And as I was going to say a journalist. I'm not really a journalist, but let's say as a media person focused on tech, it's pretty obvious that a lot of the good things and not so good things, but interesting things come out of the US. But there isn't that, the US is this like the land of the free where anything is possible and anyone can become anything they want, And certainly there was this image when I was growing up. And I don't know when it started to change. And some people have always thought that that wasn't the case. And probably rightly so, there was a little bit of idealization going on there. But I think even people who were looking up to the US are now thinking, well, there are good things. But also, and again, it's not just Trump. It's things like healthcare, the healthcare situation, and the poverty, and the obesity issue, and all of those things that make you take a step back, and which actually most of those are relatively recent, I think. It's like 30 years or so for many of those, not for all of them, obviously. I'm thinking about
I've lived in authoritarian countries now for the past almost 10 years.
Okay, so
Vietnam,
you're not counting
China,
France
and the DRC. No, that's a communist country, but not an authoritarian country.
So you've lived, in Vietnam and China and...
And the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, right. And which is not really authoritarian, it's just chaos there. And the idea that people really needed the United States as a concept to exist, because in these countries, it was always messed up. But there was this idea that somewhere better existed, and that gave people a lot of excitement and hope. And particularly in places like Vietnam, where it was and it still is very much a dream to go and migrate to the United States. Because it is more free, because you can be more, because you can break out of a caste system that you wouldn't necessarily be able to break out of in other countries. And the fact that this is now fading is sad for the world, because we need that type of ideal that's out there. And you're right, it's not there and it's fading and people are starting to see it. And Americans don't really understand that the rest of the world is paying attention to what happens.
Yeah,
when Ferguson was happening... my staff came to me in Ho Chi Minh City and they said, why is the army pointing guns at people? And it was a very basic question. I had to explain, well, it's really the police and it's not the army, but I know they look like the army, but it's really, and I just said, forget it, you're right. And that's the type of disillusionment that they don't understand and that makes people sad that the United States as the ideal is fading.
Yeah.
And the ideal now has been switched in countries like in Saudi and the Middle East and so on. Now they're looking at China as an ideal country, China. Singapore. UAE.
China, if you're living in a developing country, in the past 30 years, China went from one of the poorest countries in the world to the world's second largest economy, with great infrastructure, with great economic advancement, with living standards now in some places that rival the West. And you think to yourself, I want that. And that is really an ideal. So Turkey, you're absolutely right. People are looking at China in many ways as a role model. Again, Westerners get very defensive over this. They're not free. They don't have all this. And you have to see it from a very different point of view.
And I would say my initial reaction is always, what are you talking about? Like dictatorship and communism and all of that. Although, communism with a grain of salt or 1,000, given what's happening economically. But... my reaction is always no. And I have to say, in the past maybe 10 years, I've had to put a little, we have this expression in French, we say, I put a little bit of water in my wine. So it's kind of, I mellow my certainties a little bit. And I still believe that a democracy and a republic are the best systems because of the freedom, but I'm wondering sometimes if I don't even know what I want to say. I'm just wondering sometimes. I don't have any certainties like that anymore. And the fall from grace of the US as this idyllic place is also incredibly disappointing, because it gives leeway to much more nefarious ideas and people to say, look at the US, it's not all it's trumped up to be, and it's it's not what you think, so let's do it my way, which then leads to these kinds of things which aren't always as successful as China, if successful at all. So
just one last point that I'll make is, every year I'm invited to speak at a local university here to American students who come here, and a lot of them come with the same mindset that you have about China. Mm. And one of the first things I say to them is, they're not as oppressed as you think they are, and you're not as free as you think you are. And I think that's a really, really important starting point to any discussion on China and also about our own countries in the West.
They're not as oppressed as you think they are, and you're not as free as you think they are. As you think you are. Yeah.
I think the Facebook scandal points that out.
Yeah.
Your data is being trafficked and sold. You're being watched and you're being monitored in all sorts of different ways. It's not a government doing it, but it is a corporation. And my own government is, in fact, actually doing that as well, as we know from the Snowden papers. So, come on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, the kind of thing that happened in the election in the U.S. last time. It's, you point to something that might be 20% bad and point to something that's 80% bad. And you go, see, they're the same. I would argue that they're not
the same.
But,
it's a lot of gray. There's a lot of gray.
Right, but there's different kinds of gray. And the argument that many people make when they're trying to sell you something, be it an idea or a criticism of something, is it's all gray, so it's all the same. And that's where the distinction becomes important. Anyway, all right. Dan, if you have anything to add or say, or please interrupt us because we've known each other for a while and we never stop talking. So please feel free to interrupt us.
Yeah, don't worry. And perhaps just one small point that I want to make is that it's kind of interesting how the relevance of China in particular is affecting the rest of the countries. Right now in Mexico, well, we are dealing with the NAFTA negotiations. We are, I believe, in the seventh round. And before that, we actually were of the countries that were more interested in the Trans-Pacific Treaty. And that's mainly because, well, if we're going to have a sort of a blockage in the with our main partner, which used to be the United States, we obviously have to look at different parts of the world so we can have commercial treaties. And in this case, perhaps we're being a little bit used by the Chinese governments or corporations because we can help in the way that we are like a point of connection with the rest of the continent. We are really close to the United States, but also it's a main point, so it can enter to the rest of the countries below. And that's a particular case in the case in the situation of Didi Xu Xing, which actually opened offices last year, and it was mainly as a point of entrance to see if they can make business here that will be easier for in this case this Chinese corporation to enter the United States. So it's something that we have to be really looking at because it will affect us economically very soon.
So let's not make jokes about walls preventing stuff to enter and pass the okay, but you are. So how do you look at, how does your media look at China now, and maybe especially that removal of the term limit for Xi Jinping? How was it relayed?
In this case, well, with the relationship, it's kind of interesting because it has been something that has been working for a while. I remember that in the mid-90s, we actually start having a lot of development in parts for Chinese industry in some states like Guanajuato, well, some states in the center of the country. So it has been like something that it doesn't come as a surprise because for different sectors that are really important, for example, the shoemaking or clothing, we start seeing more presence of Chinese products because they are really cheap, so it's easier to sell, but also the components, even for cars. So when we have the entrance, in this case of Didi Xu Xing in the marketplace in here, it was used like a natural step in that way here in
right,
Mexico.
Right, no, but I mean the removal of the term limit, you know, who can... Xi Jinping can now be president for life.
I'm so sorry. Yes. Sorry. I was thinking about that. sorry, it's just because I was thinking about taking a car later. Yeah, well, it didn't exactly come as a surprise, but it also was like, well, they are putting in paper something that was thinking that was coming in a way, because for how long has he been in the government as the head of the government?
Oh,
Seven years?
So this is, he's starting a second 5-year term.
Hmm. All right. So it's actually a shorter period, as you made the comparison before, Eric, that perhaps with some European countries. However, the reception that he has been, the population of the country has been very, 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 let's say, very positive. So that was perhaps why it didn't come as much as a surprise. Hmm.
And, you know, obviously that reception was great in China because you couldn't hear anyone who thought otherwise. So so let's talk quickly about the North Korean aspect of the news from the past few days. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Eric, before we move on to
So the big news was that Kim Jong-un came to Beijing and it was his first overseas visit. And this is really being interpreted as a power play again by Xi Jinping in many ways to box out Trump, that any deal with the North Koreans will have to go through Beijing first. And one has to really remember that the American agenda and the Chinese agenda are radically different here. And there's always been this frustration in the United States of why aren't the Chinese doing more to help us? and to help bring this this madman under control, or little rocket man under control. And it's because the Chinese don't share the same outcomes that they that the Americans want. The Chinese prefer to maintain the status quo. The worst nightmare for the Chinese is that the North Korean government implodes, and that South Korea and American troops end up on the Chinese border. That is literally their worst case scenario. Nuclear war is obviously something that they want to avoid as well, but their goal is to make sure that the status quo in North Korea remains as a buffer against the South Koreans and the Americans being present on their border. And so Xi Jinping wanted to kind of get back involved in this. He'd been marginalized a little bit up until now. I think Trump's announcement over the direct talks with Kim Jong-un really kind of shocked people in Beijing. And so this was a move to be able to say, okay, Washington, if you want to play ball in this part of the world, you're going to have to go through Beijing and have to go through Xi Jinping. And it was a very deft move. And it also presented Kim Jong-un as a more rational player here. We've always come to seeing Kim Jong-un as a wild man. Certainly Trump has characterized him as a little rocket man and as a crazy madman. And we're starting to see the display of a more rational Kim Jong-un in a more diplomatic, more professional type of diplomat that we haven't seen up until now.
I think the way we looked at it was, again, probably because we're, we look only at ourselves and we're Westerners, but the way it was interpreted was really Trump's position was diminished in that conversation when he also shocked the world when he announced there were going to be talks with North Korea. It kind of started to feel like, oh, maybe he did play his cards right, and he does know what he's doing in this weird confrontation that they keep having over Twitter. And this was kind of a either perceived or real a coup by China, and maybe to an extent even in which North Korea was involved, going like attacking Trump's credibility. So I think that's how we looked at it from here, not destroying it, but going like Trump is on the back foot on that negotiation, which apparently he had been taking a better position in.
Remember that China can end this show tomorrow if they want to. All the fuel for North Korea comes from China. A lot of the black market trade, which has been cut considerably, comes from China. So if China decides that they want to turn this off, they can turn off the fuel taps and that's it. North Korea basically just withers away. They don't want to do that. Again, that's not their incentive to do that. The Chinese certainly have leverage that they're not using. They have an agenda that is radically different than the United States.
Right.
China is encircled by nuclear powers now. So it is comfortable. It's gotten comfortable with the fact that India, Pakistan, Russia, now, obviously, the United States, which is and off its shore, and North Korea all have nuclear weapons. So that by itself doesn't really intimidate the Chinese. And they recognize the value of what Kim has done. And also because Kim has been a very rational actor, because the nuclear card has been very effective as a bargaining power with the United States. I mean, certainly the United States would not take North Korea seriously if it didn't have nuclear weapons.
Right.
So in some ways, when the Americans characterize him as a madman, it's the ultimate act of rationality. I mean, that is a great card for him to be playing right now. And I just don't see how the United States, and now with John Bolton coming in as the national security advisor, what their options are. Are they really going to go to war in this part of the world? Really?
Well,
I mean, the war game scenario I would say catastrophic beyond imagination.
Yeah, I would say obviously not.
Catastrophic, I mean.
But who knows? Yeah,
you never know.
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, Seoul is 20 minutes away from the North Korean border. I mean, the scenarios are beyond catastrophic for what it would be. But no one really believes that the Americans are going to go to war in this part of the world right now. So at that point, then you're just all talk and nothing else. And that's kind of, again, what we're worried about the American presence in Asia.
All right. I think we're going to move on from China, unless anyone has anything else to add. Is Turkey playing with his lighter or something? Is that what's the clicking sound? No, Turkey? Okay, he's gone silent now.
I'm here.
Okay. So, all right, let's move away from China for a little bit. But I'm even more convinced that we have to do a special on the country at some point. But you know what? Let's talk about France for just a second and what happened there. I'm really wondering if that made the news in other countries. You'll let me know. But there are many different things we could be talking about. There have been racial tensions heating up in the country. Hopefully not too bad, but certainly present. There was obviously this terrorist attack that made a few dead a few weeks ago, which we could talk about. But the one I really want to talk about is former President Nicolas Sarkozy, who was, we were talking before the show, how you call that procedure, that police procedure in English. In French, it's called garde à vue, which is basically being detained for 24 to 48 hours as you're being investigated for a crime. And this follows a very lengthy investigation that started because of the a newspaper that made revelations that were quite important at the time, that parts of the presidential campaign of Nicolas Sarkozy back in his first campaign, I believe, now I'm not certain. I'm pretty sure it was the first one. Came from Libyan money from Gaddafi directly, and that Nicolas Sarkozy was to an extent involved in that, which would have been all manners of illegal. And this has been going back and forth for a very long time, and now in a very surprising and impressive event, the former president, as I said, was actually detained. So detained, it doesn't mean he is arraigned. He's not formally, how do you say it? Like, not accused, but...
he hadn't been charged.
Charged. Yes, thank you, Eric. That's the word I was looking for anything. But it's the potentially the first steps for that, and there are some very serious suspicions going his way. And this is something that we didn't really think was possible. Of course, he's defending himself in the ways that any politician would. I don't know that he's guilty or innocent. I'm not sure anyone does. Certainly, there are many indications that seem to show that he's at least not completely clean in that whole thing. And so that was the big news for a few days in the country. It wasn't a huge surprise that it would happen, but I guess no one really thought that it would actually happen. It's like, yeah, he's probably somewhat guilty. There's some fishy things happening there or things that happened. But we've never seen actually a former president being quote-unquote dragged. He wasn't dragged. He was, you know, very formally invited. He even went back home to sleep for the night, which can happen in some very specific cases for high-profile people. Might be unfair, but sure. It happened. And it's like the country is divided, I think, between bewilderment and, again, because we thought it might happen, but we didn't think it would actually happen, and kind of not a spirit of, it's not really revenge. It's like, well, that's what was coming to you, so good for it actually happening. And I guess my personal position is just, well, if he's done the things he's being accused of, then yeah, he should be detained, charged, prosecuted, and condemned if he's deemed guilty. But yeah, there was certainly there's at the same time, even for me, who's more on the right side of the political spectrum in France, there's a sentiment of, well, tough shit. That's justice. You know, no matter who you are, you should be liable to be prosecuted for what you do. And it's kind of a half pride. Like, I'm at the same time a little bit ashamed that the guy I supported and I think, you know, was a good answer for some issues in the country, not so good in others, but that I supported is involved in all of this, But at the same time, you know, it's the pride that I live in a country where this can actually happen. So justice does work, and I guess it's in sharp contrast with what was discussed just before. But yeah, so that's the main topic I would say I would like to point out from what happened in France. And I'm curious if you guys heard about it. I'm wondering if it's not maybe too local for other countries to discuss, maybe no, specifically some countries here.
Okay. Especially the Gaddafi part.
Right. Obviously, of course. So how was it?
Patrick.
Yep. Go ahead.
Sorry, Patrick. Just one question in here. For example, in France, do you have a trust in this case, in the process and that it will be being taken seriously and that actually there won't be any kind of, I don't know, mysterious movements so he can be freed of these charges, right?
No, I think it will be done seriously. I think some people will tell you, like, if he's found not guilty, there will definitely be some people who will say, oh, well, you know, they were lenient because he's the former president, or they manipulated the thing, or of course, you know, he's found not guilty because some kind of thing happened. But I think what we've seen until now is that justice does follow its course. And what we've seen in the previous, you know, the last election was that people are following through on these things and the justice system is working. And we had a very serious potential president for the current presidency that was basically ruled out because of revelations from the press that were followed up by the justice system. And so, yeah, I would say when I think about Mexico, I'm thinking, maybe there would be some arrangements. France is not perfect in that regard specifically, but I think in this case and in most cases, the follow-through would be reliable.
Really?
Yeah,
let me challenge you here a little bit. You call this justice. I call it politics.
Okay.
And there's a very big difference. How many French presidents or prime ministers are sitting in jail right now?
None.
Have ever been sent? None. Never.
No, but that's why it's so important.
He will never spend a day in jail. But you're telling me that, you know, from the time of Charles de Gaulle in France-Afrique, that millions and millions of dollars were being brought up from Gabon and other, you know, from Ivory Coast and other places to fund French presidential elections. And the dirtiness of French politics is corrupt as the day is long. And the idea that the French justice system is finally catching up with them is ridiculous to me. They're catching the dumb and the slow for political reasons, not for justice reasons. And I think to confuse justice and politics to me is a very, very dangerous thing. The French political system, we know, is rotten to the core. We know it's rotten to the core. It's been rotten to the core for decades, going back deep into the colonial period, where money was coming in, dark money. What was the Sarkozy involved in the Pakistani affair too, where money was coming in from Pakistan as well for illicit business deals? Whatever happened with that? Nothing. So the justice system really favors the elites. It does not crack down on these people. We don't see presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers going to jail to serve any real prison time. So if I saw a French president and prime minister behind bars, great. But yet, if you go out to the banlieue and you see the way that the CRS are cracking down on immigrants and migrants, there's not fairness there. It's no more fair in France than it is in the United States.
I think you're being a little bit.
Here's what I resent the most is that the French get up on a pedestal and start lecturing other countries about governance and anti-corruption. And that, to me, is the most ridiculous thing. When I was living in Kinshasa, listening to the French propaganda coming out about corruption was just, it's obscene. And yet it happens just in plain sight in France.
Okay,
how is that possible?
I will say two things. First of all, I'll go back to the...
nothing else.
What?
We're making entertaining for audience if nothing else.
Yeah, entertaining for the audience. You broke up a little bit towards the end, Eric. But I'll say two things. First of all, I'll go back to the 20% and 80% comment I made earlier saying, you know, some things are light gray, some things are dark gray. And I think you're, again, trying to say, well, it's all gray, so it's all the same, and they're all corrupt.
It's not all the same, but you, if you have corrupt leaders lecturing other people about corruption, that just seems a little ironic to me, if nothing else.
Well, that is a very different comment from the one you made just seconds ago. So I would take this one. I wouldn't necessarily take the one you made before. And the other thing I will say is, so yes, sure, there are some issues in French politics. There are some issues in every political system in the world, and some more even in the Western world than it is in France. If you start looking at, I don't know, Italy or Greece or some other countries, you can find examples where there are really outrageous things that are happening. And the other thing I will say, it's a long, arduous process to clean up all of this. And I do think that we are in, you know, slowly cleaning up our act. And I think that we are not worse than many other Western countries. And that, you know, except maybe for the Nordics, who have some kind of superhuman ability to be ethical, which we should look up to, and hopefully some of us do. But we are cleaning up our act, and it's not, you know, it's not, we shouldn't be thinking that this is all doomed. I think there are ways out of it, and we are taking the steps slowly, one by one, to clean things up. There are many things that have been changed in the parliamentary system, in the government system, to remove elements of funding that were untraceable, and some, you know, black box funds that you could use for anything you wanted if you were a parliamentary member of the parliament, things like that. And this, I want to see it as another step towards more accountability for our politicians. And sure, you could say, yeah, but it's all rotten, so none of it matters, which you were over, you know, exaggeratingly saying earlier. And yeah, but then you choose to kind of throw the whole baby, water, bath, and bathroom together in the sea. And I'm not ready to do that. I think we have a system that is not perfect, that is, but it is perfectible. And those are steps that we're taking to make it so. So that's,
I admire your optimism. I really admire your optimism. It's needed in these days.
Yeah, exactly. I'm counterbalancing all of that negativity I was talking about earlier. All right. So you were saying, Turkey, that you heard about it, especially from the Gaddafi angle. Can you tell us a little bit more about how it was received?
I'm not exactly sure how it was received, because it was just a news thing that people have been looking into because of the Gaddafi relationship, that Gaddafi has had influences here and there, and that's how he lasted that so long in his rule, because of the support he had from politicians from Western countries.
Well, ironically, mostly. He didn't last very long while this presidency was happening. But but yeah, is that like fuel for the idea that these democracies, we're getting back to the same idea, but like these democracies aren't as free and fair as they try to portray themselves, as we were talking earlier?
Yeah, that is an MO that's been used by people who would claim stuff like that. The mentality is, in many of the Middle East countries right now, and Saudi specifically, has moved from freedom and rights and so on to safety and security. Mm. So that's what people would look when I discussed anything in Saudi with people in Saudi Arabia, and I mention some matters about rights or freedom, they would say, "Oh, just be grateful that we're safe."
Right, right.
And that's the mentality that a lot of people are looking at, and that's why countries like China, like Singapore, like the United Arab Emirates are becoming role models for some of these countries. Even though all of these countries I mentioned, they don't have much of a human rights freedom. It's more of security. They're prospering. They have good lives and so on. But their freedoms are very limited.
All right. Dan, did you hear about that Sarkozy thing, or should we move on to something else? Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, just a small comment, but actually it was in line with my question before, because we heard about that, and that was why I was wondering if there was actually some trust for the institutions in this case, that the process was going to go in the proper way, because at least in this side of the world, we really don't have a lot of trust in the institutions, particularly when we're dealing with politicians or governors or authority people, authority figures, because usually we there's no proper due process in there, and we can see it even with them or with their with their relatives. Early this morning, I was just checking some news that in one of the most terrible cases of violence in here, there were like a group that is called Los Porquis, which it's some teenagers who are sons of important figures, either politics or in business. And they actually did something terrible like 1 year ago, and they just kidnapped a teenager girl. They actually raped her, and the process didn't go far. And this morning they released one of these, there were four kids, and that was like a sense of frustration in this particular case because it was horrible. And because the parts that were involved were like, well, the judge was pretty much in the case that we don't have enough evidence, even when one of these young teenagers actually did confess about this, but because he's, well, he's 16 or 15 years old, we cannot do something like that. But the real reason was because his father was the CEO of a power corporation and had a political connection. So that's why we have certain skepticism if the process actually goes in this case with Sarkozy. I know that it's a really different topic, but the thing with the institutions, and I believe that that's something that Eric also mentioned in there, it's we have very different perspectives in these cases.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree. I don't think that, if I'm being completely honest, I don't think Sarkozy is going to end up behind bars. He might be condemned, though. And if we reframe the question about have politicians ever been condemned to, you know, in being not being eligible for a certain time or having to pay fines and stuff like that, that has happened many times, and maybe that's how it's going to go for him as well.
Is that justice, though? I mean, really?
I don't know. It depends what they're accused of. But I will agree, Eric, that at least until now, justice hasn't been served properly for politicians in the country. Probably not consistently. I agree with that. I'll give you that.
Good.
We'll see what happens.
Let's go to a lighter topic.
Sure, Dan, would you like to take us to a lighter topic for news from Mexico?
Yes, let's talk politics. No, well, just a small reference in this case. We're going to go into the general elections in July of this year, and we have three main candidates. One of them, it's actually somebody who has been running for office for longer than 12 years. He has lost two elections, and right now he's at the head. In the polls, he's like with over 30% of the preference of the audience. And the other two candidates that are closer, they're like kind of far, like with 20 and 15%. And I mentioned this because 3 days ago, in one of the nice neighborhoods here in Mexico, it's called Las Lomas, people start noticing that in the trees that are near one of the avenues in this part of the neighborhood, there was a capuchin monkey. So this actually was sensational for all the news. He was appearing in all the news, and people were obviously calling the police, the fire department, the firemen, so they could rescue this monkey. And he was all over the news, and they actually tried to compare with the popularity that the candidates had, and actually the monkey came in second place. So it's actually something that was like, I would rather vote for him than for the rest of the candidates, to be quite honest. So that tells you how the state of the other candidates is with the general population.
How would you vote? Would you vote for the monkey or one of the candidates?
One of the things is that you have you can vote for the parties, and you also have a blank slate, so you can add your own candidates. So Capuchin Monkey, I believe that he right now has over 25% of the preference in the country.
And what role is Trump playing in the election right now? What, how are people feeling about that in terms of the candidates? How are they positioning themselves in relation mm-hmm. to Trump's policy towards Mexico?
It's kind of peculiar because I remember
we said the fun topics, Eric. Fun topics.
Well, Trump sorry, is always
go ahead, Dad. Trump is fun. That's true. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, yeah, it depends in what side of the wall you are. In this case, it has come to a second place because, as I mentioned before, we are very near the election. So that's actually the main topic. The last time that I had the chance to talk with you, Patrick, and with you, Turkey, well, it was after Trump was elected and the promises of the wall were like a big part of the deal in this case. Right now, the main focus is in the three candidates that I mentioned. The one that is at the head, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he has, let's say that he is the option for a real change. And I am using quotes when I say real change, because he's against everything that is in the system right now. Some of the promises that he has made is that he will destroy some of the proposals of the government that we have right now, like the educational reform or the energy reform. He will backtrack those ones and perhaps come with a different solution, or at least that's what he's saying. And some of the other options is that because he has this kind of perspective, the corporations and the main investors in Mexico are, you could say that, skeptics or perhaps a little bit afraid of him in this way, because he's the anti-system, the solution that comes from the outside of what it's already established in the control points in the power system that we have in here. The other candidates that we have in second and in third place are pretty much kind of the same. A little bit of context is that, for example, in Mexico, we used to have three main parties. One is the one that was ruling for over 70 years, the PRI or Partido Revolucionario Institucional. And we had a break from there in the 2000s. A different party was actually for two periods taking control, but it was pretty much the same for the rest of the population. The main candidate that I was mentioning, López Obrador, mm-hmm. he doesn't come from this party, so that's why he's been seen as a different option. However, in case that he wins, he also has a perspective more focused within the country. He's like, well, if we cannot deal in this case with Trump, with the United States, don't worry. We will establish and use the policies that we have in the 70s, when we actually didn't need a lot of help or a lot of participation in the global market. But as we know, that perhaps could have worked in the 70s or in the 60s. Right now is not a solution. So that one of the main criticisms that people in general have against him is that he tries to bring forward some of the policies that perhaps sounded better before. But right now, they are not realistic solutions. But because it's something different, because he's from outside the government, he has gained a lot of momentum. And I have to say that I'm a little bit afraid that he's going to be elected because he doesn't have a real plan. However, one final thing in this aspect is that as I mentioned before, he has run for office two times before. He has lost both times. And the main thing is that his worst enemy is himself. So we are waiting for the final 2 months of the general election period, just right before we have to go to vote. Because what he has done before is say something or do something that actually will make people vote for somebody else. I don't know. Maybe the monkey. I don't know.
Maybe the monkey will be elected. So let me ask you another question. You talked about the lack of trust in the justice system in the country. How much trust is there in the government in the country? Again, mm-hmm. I'm being dumb Patrick, as I often am. And if I look at Latin America and South America and Central America, I'm thinking lots of corruption and lots of drugs and, as you mentioned, lots of powerful people being being untouchable. How does the Mexican people think of their government?
Well, the institutions, let's say that they are not very credible in most of the cases. And I have a couple of examples. One of the main infrastructure things that have been done with the president that we have right now, it's an airport for Mexico City. And this airport will be, in at least in investment, it's a lot of money. It's over 700 billion pesos in here. And one of the things that the candidate that I was mentioning, the one that is at the head and it's anti-system, he says that if he actually gets elected, he's going to backtrack also this project, which has been developed for over, I don't know, 4 years, and it will be one of the main the main things. So you also seen there that there is no continuity in the institutions, and it can change according to the how the people elected wants to do it. But well, it's kind of normal. But another example that is actually a little bit more, let's say, that represents better how the people feels about the government is that for this airport, a couple of days ago, there was a news that the president, Peña Nieto, actually used part of the money for the retirement funds to finance this airport, which actually wasn't true. But a lot of people was like, yeah, you see, the government is wrong. Mm-hmm. They are even using money that is not from there. What actually happened is that some of the institutions that are in charge of investing this money are going to take participation on this infrastructure project, which is actually normal. And they are going to participate with about, I don't know, it's like 3% or 4% of the entirety of the project. But people doesn't believe that, and they rather believe the news that the government is using the money that is yours and they are going to steal from you. Mm. So that, I believe that actually explains it better.
So let me ask you the question in another way. How many people uh-huh. care about the election? How many people are going to go vote?
I mentioned before that. Yeah. I mentioned before that, for example, in the 2000s, when we finally changed from the PRI to the PAN, from the main party to a different party, the people who went to vote, it was about 76%, something around that, which was really high. For this election, even though the main contender has about 30% of the preferences, people who are going to go to vote, it's around 46 to 48%. So you can see that it actually has declined a lot. Wow. Also, because people think that the vote that they can cast won't affect as much because everything is rigged.
Yeah, okay. Okay, let's move on to, that's kind of depressing again, but...
Sorry about that. Monkeys.
Monkeys, yes. Do you think everything is rigged? What do you think?
I personally, it all depends. And I say this because, for example, I right now live in Mexico City. But at this very moment, I visiting my parents with and they live in a very small city, which is in a different part of the country. And for a lot of time, I actually, instead of having my main ID and my voter's card registered in Mexico City, I rather vote in a smaller city because my vote actually could count for a bigger difference, for a bigger percentage. Mm. And in smaller cities, you actually see the switch of power between the different parties. In the main election, it's harder because, well, you have institutions that are backing up, in this case, the candidates. And it's kind of sad because what happens in Mexico City, a lot of people think that this is what happens in the rest of the country, which is not like that. If you go to the north of the country, to the southeast, well, to different parts of the country, a lot of people doesn't actually support the main candidate that I was mentioning before. But because he's in the news, because he's in the capital city of the country, a lot of people believe that you cannot change the preference in this case for the vote. Mm. So in the smaller scale, yes, you can have change. You can have... you can have a different perspective and you can affect, in this case, the elections in a better way. However, I'm going to switch to another news to different news that was a little bit interesting. You can see in the smaller scale that also the politicians are using to carry the votes to their own party, different strategies. One different example, I believe that you watch anime series, right, Patrick?
Like, yep. I don't know. Well, I mean, I did a lot, a little bit less now, but let's say yes.
All right. So, for example, Dragon Ball Super, it's one of the most popular animes right now. And for the season finale, for the episode 130, in different parts of the country, they were actually offering to stream in public places, like in plazas or in plazas. They were offering to actually stream the episodes for free so the people could watch it. And you could see governors saying that, or mayors of cities saying that, yeah, we're going to get the rights, even though it was actually not in the legal way when you look at the fine print.
Right.
So they just have the preference of the audiences in these cities, and they did it in four cities. And you had even the release from Toei Animation. They are the creators of this anime. Right. And they were like, look, guys, for this kind of procedure, you actually have to go to a lot of paperwork so you can own the rights. But no, because they find a sort of a void in the tramites. And they actually use one reference that perhaps will be familiar to you, Patrick. You remember Mexico went to war with France a long, long time ago. And in Mexico, we say that we went to war with France because we weren't willing to pay for some cakes for the cake war or La Guerra de los Pasteles. You think that we're going to pay for the streaming rights of this TV show? So right, you can see there how the institutions actually use that in their favor.
Okay, so that's how the country works. Duly noted. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Let's move on to our final topic and country, and that's Saudi Arabia. We go to Turkey. Well, Turkey the person, not the country. Although the people ask that often. You're kind of named after the strength of the Turks. Like, that's where your name comes from, right?
That's what I'm told, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. That's what you're told. Maybe the real story is different then.
God knows, but from what I'm told from linguists here, that this is the reasoning for the name Turkish, from the Ottoman's soldiers.
Oh, okay. So it's not your mom who's telling you, yeah, it was because of okay. It's actually linguists. Yeah. All right. So what happened in Saudi Arabia that's of note?
Let's see. The biggest three news articles here have been, first one was, 2-3 days ago, we had a missile attack on Saudi from Yemen.
Oh, my
Seven
God.
Missiles. Three of them actually came to Riyadh city, and they were shut down. It ended up with one death, an Egyptian expat. So that was the biggest news. Apparently, I was fast asleep, and I didn't know anything about it until I woke up.
See, missile attacks aren't that bad. You can sleep through them.
Everybody keeps on asking me, how did you sleep through it? Our homes were shaking from all the blasts.
Jeez. So, okay. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia has been concerned about the war in Yemen for a long time.
And it's part of the war in Yemen.
Yeah, involved in the war in Yemen. So, yeah. I guess that fueled up some anger and some, why aren't you doing something towards the authorities?
No, it's everybody here. Saudi Arabia has done a very good job of blaming the rebels, the Houthis, and the Iranian regime on this. So it's not our fault, it's their fault.
Okay.
They hate us and they're trying to hurt us. So.
Okay, so what's already been in place is being, like, that's already being dealt with.
Yes, what we're doing in Saudi Arabia is fighting for the freedom of the Yemeni people against their Houthi rebels and their Iranian overlords. So okay. Basically, that's how it is. Mm.
Sorry to break this. I don't know if you can hear the screams of my son getting home.
No, we can't hear it.
Mm.
Okay, well, that's good, because he's very screamy right now.
Oops.
Yeah, well, that always happens. He's generally unhappy about almost everything. So, just a second. Help.
And this is a making of.
Okay, I'll be back. We'll interrupt the show for just a second, and I'll be back.
That's a good husband. No problem.
And we're back. Sorry, Turkey, I interrupted you. Keep going.
All right. So we're talking about the attack on Riyadh. So the good thing about the attack is we have a lot of Patriot missiles, so we were able to stop them from hitting their targets. Unfortunately, the debris did end up falling in some areas, and it resulted in one death.
Okay.
The other two big news, number one is we have the Crown Prince is in the USA. He's visited with Trump, and now he's doing a tour of the country, meeting with business people and so on, trying to promote Saudi Arabia as a business hub. The second
and
big news, everybody...
You're very great friends with America, so you love that and great that he's going to America.
Sure.
No, I'm just wondering how the media is reporting on it. I mean, it's not like they can say they hate it, I suppose, but aren't the religious authorities super happy?
What did you think our media? This is a monarchy. What would you think the entire media about this trip would be?
Okay, what about the religious authorities, though?
They don't have a voice in the media. It's the most covered trip, and it's covered like we in the newspapers you would find like 5-10 pages every single day covering that event
in glowing terms.
The other big thing is people are waiting in excitement for the day when women start driving as Well, I'm not exactly sure. It's either June or July. Officially they haven't announced the rules yet, but they've already established driving schools for women. And they've started accepting applications. And we're still waiting for the regulations and see when it's going to be implemented. But it's supposed to be either June or July.
Okay, why is it more exciting now? It's been planned for a long time and it's still a couple of months away.
People are talking about it more because it's getting closer, so... That's what, and plus now you have driving schools, so it's more real for a lot of people.
Oh, the driving schools have opened.
Yes.
Okay.
So those are the big news here in Saudi.
Okay. I will be honest and say that most of this doesn't really make the news. Driving for women, I'm sure, will when it's actually implemented. But even the trip, the American trip didn't. The war in Yemen, honestly... Yeah, you kind of hear about it here and there, but maybe it's because I'm preoccupied by my newborn who eats up all my time, but it's not really a big topic.
The missiles on Riyadh, that's huge. You didn't hear of that?
I mean, I'm sure it was reported
over here.
It didn't
register over here. No, not in Asia very much. I think it's hard from the outside to follow it because there's so many kind of interesting conflicts that are going on right now. I mean, it's just hard for outsiders to keep track of all of who's on what side. Very reductionist, but at the end of the day, it's just hard.
Maybe the entire world just thinks, oh, these people just blow themselves every day. So who cares?
No, there's actually, that's
probably
not
some
the
truth to that. I mean, it's just hard to follow. Yeah.
I would say that's not the case for us. I think the war in Yemen has been talked about, but it's the same for everyone, and I guess that's what affects it for Asia, as you mentioned, Derek, as well. If it doesn't impact us in some way, then... And that's the same for everyone. You know, if it doesn't impact the U.S., they're not going to talk about it in the U.S. If it doesn't impact Saudi Arabia, they're not going to talk about it in Saudi, etc., etc. So it's not like a dig at any specific country, but in this case, as tragic as it is, it doesn't really impact us, so we're not hearing about it too much. So and slightly shortened by the return of my newborn that I was talking about earlier and his incessant screaming, I think we're going to have to bring this show to a close. But it was a good one, so I want to thank all three of you for joining us. Can you tell us where we can find your work online if people want more? Let's start with Eric.
Sure. You can find me over at the ChinaAfricaProject.com. So we do a weekly podcast And we're all over social media. You can find me on, follow me on Twitter if you want to stay on top of China Africa news, at Eolander. That's Eolander. Also, some great discussions are going on over on LinkedIn, almost 600,000 followers there, and really just intelligent, thoughtful discussions from a Chinese and African point of view. So a distinctly non-Western point of view. Every day I'm posting there. And so I invite people to come and check out what people are saying from, again, from different vantage points that you may not hear in other places.
Thank you, Eric. What about you, Dan?
Well, it will be easier just to find me in Twitter, so you can just look at me for as Dan Campos. From there, you can find different links where I talk mainly about cinema, about the production, that deals with it, with distribution, with the screenwriting and that. But this is way, as I mentioned before, it's in Twitter as Dan Campos.
And you will get the link in the show notes, as you will for Eric as well. And Turkey, obviously. What about you? Where can we find you? I guess it's Twitter.
Well, yeah, that's where you can find me, on Twitter at Turkey Albala, TurkiAlbala. I try and post as much as I can, unless when I'm really busy with work.
Cool. So LLAA. Don't forget. Yep. Excellent. Thank you very much to you, Turkey, and to all three of you. Thank you as well to the listeners for listening, and also for contributing financially to the health of the show. You can find the Patreon page at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. You can find the link to that in the show notes. It's very easy. You click there, you create an account. It takes about 2 minutes, and you can support the show. You know, $1 an episode is already something that is really appreciated. There are hundreds of people already supporting the show, and I would appreciate it very much if you would not necessarily do it, but at least consider doing it. You know, if you think the show brings some value to your life or some entertainment or something, then maybe consider giving it a buck an episode. That would be greatly appreciated. And we do take the currency of the great evil American, United States. So for all the criticism, we still take your money. So there you go. Take from that what you will. We do thank you for listening. I am Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook, so you can find me there as well. You will find the show notes at frenchspin.com. And if you want to comment, have a rebuttal, or say that we said something incoherent and silly, please feel free to do so. Frenchspin.com is one place to do that. The social media updates are also another. As I said, you can find all of the links in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye.